This is Unfortunate History.
Hey everyone, this is Cody Pennington.
And this is Greg Skinner.
Welcome to Unfortunate History, a podcast where we cover interesting, wacky, and unfortunate moments from history. And today, we will be discussing the indestructible Michael Malloy. Now, Greg, you and I both enjoy a drink every now and then, right?
Yeah, a bit too much sometimes. Yeah. A bit too much.
Sometimes, yeah. But that's fine, you know? But you say too much. Do you think you could actually have the ability to drink enough to put a pub out of business?
I don't think I'd have the ability to do it, but I've definitely tried. I'm pretty sure I've tried and got nowhere near achieving it.
Well, our main character today actually pretty much accomplished that goal in the 1930s.
How the fuck?
Yeah, and you can imagine in the 1930s, alcohol was like ridiculously strong. So he literally almost drank somebody out of house and home.
But surely, wouldn't he be keeping their business alive if he's drinking it all? He's still paying for it, surely.
Oh, well, this is all part of the story, my
friend. Okay.
Today is a really cool story. I'm actually really excited to tell this one because it's very, it's odd. It's very topsy-turvy. I'm pretty sure this is the wompiest of the womp-womp episodes we've ever done.
Okay.
It's very out of nowhere. It's kind of like, what? But Mike, the durable Malloy, was born in Donegal, Ireland in 1873. I'm almost tired of saying this, but we know nothing of his actual upbringing. What we do know is that Malloy had immigrated to America, as many other Irish people had done around the time, and he supposedly worked as a fireman and a station engineer working on industrial machines. But his work soon dried up thanks to a little-known bummer of a thing called the Great Depression, which we've kind of covered quite a bit.
Yeah, we have. That was kind of a sad time for everyone, wasn't it? You know, when it's named the Great Depression, you'd think it kind of gives it away, doesn't it?
Now, Malloy was living in New York when the Depression hit, and New York City was hit hard. People were being put out of work constantly. People that had left their home countries in search of a better life were absolutely not finding it in America and not in New York. Further still, Americans themselves were not having a good time in the Depression. We spoke about it before, like we said, but the Great Depression was an awful time period for the entire world. And as an Irishman, Malloy was obviously the kind of man to like a bit of a drink, especially in this time period. However, while today's story is taking place during the Great Depression, there was also another unfortunate thing that had swept the nation around the same time. Greg, do you know what that is?
What time are we talking about? When was this? What were we
talking? 20s and 30s.
20s and 30s. I don't know. The war?
Nope. Prohibition.
Oh, shit. I should have got that.
Yeah.
It's top of my head. I just couldn't think it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the Prohibition.
Yeah, most listeners will be familiar with the Prohibition. But for those of you that aren't familiar with it, the Prohibition was a national ban on the manufacturing, transportation, and sale of alcohol during the 1920s and 1930s. When compared to modern times, this does seem a bit odd, but at this time in history, there had already been a big temperance movement in many countries. Temperance was the abstinence from drinking alcohol. This was a huge movement. It had been a huge movement since the 1700s, so we're talking about a strong movement that would finally culminate in the Prohibition in the 1920s. However, we can safely say with the Great Depression at the same time, it's pretty bad timing.
We're in literally something called the Great Depression. Everyone's going to be, you know, pretty depressed.
Yeah.
Also, good time to go sober, guys. Let's go sober.
Yeah, exactly. Even now, as the world is battling the coronavirus, I want a beer. You know what I mean?
literally, since like lockdown, the beginning of lockdown to the end of lockdown, my recycling has been unreasonable.
Well, we would struggle. So we can only imagine how Mike Malloy, an Irishman born in the 1800s, how he must have felt in a time where no work was available and no alcohol was allowed. From Malloy's perspective, the entire movement can be seen as an attempt by the upper class to control the lower class riffraff, because you know for a fact those hoity-toity virtue-signaling pricks were still having a wine with their filet mignon. You know they were. Those fucking cunts. You know they were. This was literally a ploy to get people to stop. Actually, I believe that Prohibition was mainly brought in to try to stop crime. But people need to let off steam. You know, we can't all be at church on Sunday.
Especially in this time period.
Yeah.
Like, come on, like, this was, like, drinking was a big thing. It's a big thing now, but back then, it's all people had to do.
Yeah. That's literally all they had to do. But anyway, you can see the trouble in which Mike Molloy would find himself. However, he wasn't the only person subject to the terrible time period. A few of his acquaintances were suffering as well. Tony Marino, the bar owner, Red Murphy, the barman, Frank Pascal, the undertaker, Daniel Kreisberg, the fruit seller, and Hershey Green, the cabbie. All of whom will soon have a deadly part to play in Mike Molloy's story. And collectively, they would come to be known as the Murder Trust.
I thought it's just about a dude who could drink a lot.
It's definitely centered around a dude that could drink a lot. This will be a alcohol-heavy episode. Use this episode as a drinking game. And whenever I say the word alcohol or any type of alcohol-related sentence, take a shot and you will be plastered by the end of this episode.
Okay, it's a good. I'm gonna choose to give that a miss because it's Monday.
Yeah, fair enough.
And I am currently no longer in lockdown.
Yeah. Now, we've already set the scene for our story as during the Great Depression and Prohibition. So some listeners may wonder how Tony Marino could actually own a bar if the Prohibition was happening. Well, that's because this bar was a speakeasy. And I hope I'm not insulting anyone's intelligence by telling you this information. I just want to be thorough. But a speakeasy was a hidden bar that operated during Prohibition that allowed people to have a damn drink once in a while.
Mm. I'm pretty sure these must have been kind of common, I'm guessing.
They were huge. They were actually how Al Capone got his start, apparently. I think Al Capone made $60 million by just running liquor to and from speakeasies. So they were huge businesses, but they were obviously underground. But there were also some states and some cities that didn't like Prohibition, and they didn't necessarily enforce it, although they couldn't have it working out in the open. So this speakeasy might be there, a hidden bar, and everybody might know it's there, but they may not go and close it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually going to give a caveat here with some speakeasy information, because speakeasies are very interesting bits of history, and it will also help to set the stage a bit for our story. Now, first of all, the age of jazz music was actually truly ushered in by speakeasies. And this actually ties in directly to our Emmett Till episode. Our listeners might remember, and Greg, you'll remember, the Great Migration that we discussed, where 6 million African Americans migrated from the South to the North. I'm sure you remember that.
I do.
Now, as you would expect, some of the African Americans were musicians, and they were jazz musicians, blues musicians, obviously. These musicians traveled to northern cities like Chicago, and they were in turn employed by gangsters who owned speakeasies. Gangsters owned a large majority of speakeasies.
Yeah, it's underground empire and all that sort of stuff.
It's literally their bread and butter.
Yeah.
Now, the gangsters began spreading the word of this new, quote, fun and exciting music. And soon, speakeasies were bouncing with jazz music all over the country. So that's how they actually brought in jazz, the jazz age. It's pretty interesting.
So they were essentially the original jazz club.
I think they're even the jazz club now. If you go into a lot of jazz clubs, even in like Scotland and stuff, they're set up like speakeasies. But another interesting bit of information on speakeasies is the development of the martini and mixed drink culture. Prior to Prohibition, America was very well known for its cocktails. However, Prohibition forced the country's best mixologists to travel to other countries or find new professions. And further to that, the alcohol that was now being served was not regulated like it had been. It was incredibly strong compared to what people were used to, and it tasted like absolute dog shit.
Would this have essentially been moonshine? Was it this what was this what they had to drink?
It was moonshine, but also bathtub gin. This is where this started. So, I mean, obviously, you think about gin created in a bathtub, but it sold really well. But yeah, they were made in homes. They weren't made in factories, and they weren't regulated on how much alcohol content they could have. They tasted like absolute ass. It was not good. Now, because of that, people began having martinis and other mixed drinks to dilute the strong alcohol's flavor. So actually, the next time you have a Jack and Coke, you can thank the speakeasies of the 20s for making it a possibility. That's where mixed drinks come from.
But come on, that's not a Jack and Coke in like a hard cocktail is it? It's like, let me just put this whiskey and this Coke together. Oh my God, I'm a genius.
Well, they're not talking about just Jack and Coke. They're talking about gin and tonics and everything like that. So all types of mixed drinks. Not just, I mean, obviously you're thinking cocktails. These weren't necessarily cocktails. They're more mixed drinks.
Yeah, okay.
And actually, another bit of information further to that with the Prohibition. I didn't know this, but when people were really trying hard to bring temperance into America and to bring on the Prohibition, they were really trying to push people to drink Coke. And that's actually why they referred to Coke as a soft drink, because it's a soft drink as opposed to alcohol being the hard drink.
Hmm. That's interesting. No, I always wondered why it was called a... I guess I kind of knew it makes sense to do a soft drink, hard drink, but... I suppose if that, yeah, imagine if that had taken off, like everyone was like, oh, well, we'll just drink Coke now.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't be any alcohol. No one would have any teeth.
Well, actually, they all drank Coke, and there was, I think it was around this time, or maybe it was just before. I think they still had cocaine in it.
Woo! When Coca-Cola was still fun.
Well, just before they started advertising it as the as the drink to have as opposed to alcohol, it was originally advertised as a medical, like a medicinal product. So it would help literally everything, like impotence and everything. They said that you can literally get boners from drinking Coke, which I can imagine if it had cocaine in it, it probably would give you a raging hard-on.
No, I think you'd do the exact opposite. It's known to give you a tiny little shriv, Willie.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
No comment.
Neither here nor there. Now, another interesting thing about speakeasies. Not really interesting, but another thing about speakeasies, especially in relation to Tony Marino's speakeasy, is that they didn't always make great money, at least not during the Great Depression. They didn't always. It's just like today, you have successful and unsuccessful pubs. Some of the larger ones owned by gangsters may have turned a healthy profit, but Marino was no gangster, and he and his friends were in the same boat as everybody else, just like Malloy, poor, down on their luck, and near homelessness. Because of this, Marino and his four previously mentioned friends began to cook up new ways to turn a profit. One of the group came out with the idea for a scheme that had been used by many up to this point. The good old insurance scam.
Good old insurance scam.
Yeah.
Right from... Well, again, that's something that's gone on forever, isn't it? As long as there's been insurance, there's been insurance scams.
H.H. Holmes literally killed someone. Everybody that he killed, he had insurance policies on. So, I mean, you're talking serial killers did it forever. Now, most of you true crime buffs will know the insurance scams from many different killers. Basically, you take out life insurance on someone, then you make sure the policy pays out. You kill them. So, just so we're clear.
if I ever hear like something that someone's taken out a life insurance thing on me, I'm going to start being worried. Look.
Yeah.
That's a sign for me to panic. Like, wait, what? Why?
Nobody brings insurance. Nobody puts insurance policies out on random people, or friends don't put insurance policies on friends. That, write that down. Put that on a T-shirt. You know what I mean? Yeah. Friends don't let friends drive drunk, and they don't let friends take out insurance policies on each other.
Hey, by the way, I've just taken out this quite handsome insurance policy, you know, just in case. I want to look after you. Like, why? What are you up to?
And it pays double if you die violently. Isn't that crazy?
If you die by bludgeoning, it's triple.
Now, it's not entirely certain which of the men floated the idea of the insurance scam, but I would argue that it was Marino, the owner of the bar, because this wasn't actually his first time using the scam, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
3 years prior to meeting Malloy, Marino, a married man, had a girlfriend on the side by the name of Maybelle Carlson. She came from a somewhat wealthy family, but had fallen into a relationship with Tony Marino at some point. He wasn't in the upper class by any means, but they somehow just got together. This would prove to be a fatal decision on her part. Apparently, Maybelle was prone to drinking a bit too much sometimes, so Tony decided to take advantage of this. After taking out an insurance policy on her, Tony waited until Mabel had passed out from drinking. He then poured a full bucket of cold water on her and opened a window. This was during the New York winter, which can very easily get below freezing temperature frequently. Thus, Mabel died that night from hypothermia, and Tony collected on his money.
That's a really creative way to kill someone. That's it's stupid, but it's clever. Like,
yeah, it is clever.
That's like an easy way to get away with killing. I don't know how to explain someone's having water got poured over the Red Bull. I suppose you could say they did it to himself before they went to sleep, and then lo and behold, they woke up with a frozen head.
I suppose you could say they just spilt it on him before they tumbled into bed and passed out. You could leave a, if you know what, just put an empty glass next to the table or next to the bed.
It's like a little tiny glass, but she's literally been drenched.
She's fucking soaking wet.
She looks like frozen head to toe. Oh, I can see what happened here.
They go to pick her up and her legs pop off because they're fucking frozen solid. And she got a little shot glass of water next to the bed. It was definitely the water. Well, 3 years after killing Mabel, Mike, or allegedly, I gotta say it's alleged, but there are a lot of people, especially a documentary I watched on YouTube, that think that it definitely was Tony Marino who did that, because she did die next door to the speakeasy. So he killed her. Now,
the life insurance probably insurance policy may have been a bit of a giveaway there, but
yeah, absolutely.
I suppose they can't prove it. And this was during the Great Depression. I think everyone was kind of struggling to do anything.
I'm pretty sure everybody was doing this. They were all doing this to each other. That's why New York survived, because people thought everybody was nice and friendly to each other up there. No, they were just trying to collect on insurance scams they had on each other. There was like, you know, you might have like 15 people paying your insurance premiums. You don't even fucking know.
He thinks he's just got so many friends. Like, everyone kept saying hello to me. He's like, how are you feeling? You're feeling a bit unwell. Now I feel fine. Oh, well, you're looking a bit unwell. Here, eat this weird looking substance. Okay, thanks, man.
Jeez, everybody's so nice here.
I can see where this is going. Yeah. You know what we call this guy? Indestructible. And people have been just trying to make him die, and he just won't die. Is that where this is going?
Let's just wait. We're getting there now. Well, 3 years after the death of Mabel, Mike Malloy walked through the door of Tony's speakeasy and began drinking him out of house and home, which sparked the idea for the scam that Tony had pulled on Mabel. However, Mike Malloy would not, in any way, shape, or form, make it easy on Tony Marino and the other members of the Murder Trust. Now, when Mike Malloy first walked into Tony's speakeasy, he was down on his luck, as everyone was. And he was offered credit for his drinks, which he promised to repay, which is a normal thing in those times. And he did promise to repay, but he did not.
I was going
to
say that. How many people is going to take up a tab in this time? Like, oh, I'll definitely repay, even though I've got no fucking money or job or anything.
Yeah. But he kept coming back, and he kept getting credit, and he kept drinking. And it wasn't long before Marino had enough. He approached his four friends and told them of his plan to take out an insurance policy on Malloy, then kill him. If they wanted, they could all join in on the scam and they would split the money five ways. As they were all struggling, they readily agreed. I should point out that the amount was relatively low for an insurance payout. They would be looking at around $3,500 in total. So $3,500 in total. And in today's time, or a couple of years ago, that would be around $50,000 to $60,000 split between five people. Mm. I mean, it's not a ton, but it is somewhat. But it's not an incredible amount to actually kill someone.
You know, for a life.
Yeah, exactly. Now, either way, the men all agreed and the policy was taken out. All that was left was to kill Malloy.
But they're really considering doing the exact same thing that they did to the other woman, like freezing his head.
Not yet.
Oh!
The men decided that it was best to find a way to kill Malloy in a way that showed no harm to his body, mm-hmm. and where there was no witnesses. Mm-hmm. They felt that the most obvious way to take Malloy out was to let him do it himself. They just needed to give him a little nudge. So Marino decided to offer Malloy his drinks all on the house for a full night, nonstop, and they challenged him to drinking contests, and they kept him drinking nonstop. The men sat in the speakeasy, convinced Malloy to drink and drink and drink, and he drank and drank and drank, happily accepting every single drink. Surprisingly, even after drinking bottles of whiskey, Malloy was no closer to dying than any of the other men. Apparently, the men had forgotten that Mike Malloy was Irish.
Yeah.
So the first attempt on Mike's life was a failure.
Literally, you just provided him with a good time for free.
That's all they did, yeah. Well, the men then decided that since Malloy liked to drink so much, they would offer him a bit of the, quote, good stuff, the stronger stuff. And instead of whiskey, they offered Malloy antifreeze.
fucking hell. That's not even a drink.
It's not. It's a very, very deadly poison. It's obviously has its uses as a chemical, but it's very deadly if you ingest it. Antifreeze is very likely to kill you within an hour, sometimes 30 minutes if you ingest enough of it. And Malloy ingested a ton of it. A lot. He kept drinking shots of it. A lot. However, he didn't die. Greg, do you want to know why he didn't die? Listeners, do you want to know why he didn't die?
Honestly, I'm trying to think of logical reasons why that wouldn't kill you. Just a weird lining of the stomach. Did he eat a hearty meal before he went out?
I can give you a reason. I can tell you a pretty boring scientific reason I found online told by a somewhat large woman.
Definitely knows her stuff then.
She definitely does.
Stuff then. What is it then?
The reason that he didn't die is because the murder trust, all of the members were absolute idiots. Not necessarily that they should know this information, but they were dumb. And actually, it is said that one of them, I think it was Tony Marino, was a chemist in a previous life, so he actually should have known this. Now, apparently, the men were giving Malloy the alcohol, so the shots of alcohol, which contains ethanol, they were giving that to him constantly. And in between these drinks, they'd also give him the antifreeze, which contains methanol. Well, what the men didn't actually know was that the ethanol they were giving beforehand, so the actual alcohol shots, they were taking the place inside Malloy's body. The places it was making its way to were the areas the methanol needed to travel to in order to kill Malloy. So since there was no place for the methanol to go inside his body, it was just excreted. Had they given him the alcohol after the antifreeze, it would have likely killed him. Basically, being a drunk saved Malloy's life.
That's... How the fuck does that work? I understand what you were saying, but that's... So, look, just the alcohol... Like you said, the alcohol saved him then, so the fact he was a pisshead... I would have totally survived that murder attempt.
The amount of alcohol he had already had in his system, when that was mixed in with the methanol, the alcohol was already taking up so much of his body, so his body had to just excrete. So he just had to piss out all of the methanol, all the antifreeze. So I'm sure he did ingest some of it, and some of it got into his body, but not enough to kill him because he had already had so much alcohol inside of him. It does. They do say that in it takes like 100 milliliters of antifreeze to kill you quickly. So I can imagine that he was drinking way more alcohol than 100 milliliters. And at a lower levels, they say that antifreeze can affect your eyesight and all that kind of stuff. So he probably did have some kind of symptoms, but he was an Irishman in the 1800s. Yeah, in the 1800s. He didn't care if his eyesight was fading, you know?
He just wake up one morning, like, oh, I'm blind in one eye. That's pretty normal in this time.
That's a Tuesday. That's a fucking Tuesday for him. Yeah, absolutely.
My toes are falling off. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I don't know. Let's go get a drink. So that is attempt number two. And Mike Malloy is not dead. Now, at this point, the men decided that drinks of any kind would just not kill this man. So they decided to try food instead. The men found a tin can of sardines in the bar and left them out for days until they spoiled. They then made a sandwich.
How is this what their plan was?
I know.
<They're> like, Death Boy sandwich. So did he not smell it? Rotten sardines doesn't smell good.
No, it doesn't. They then made a sandwich with these sardines. And thinking the sardines wouldn't be enough to kill Malloy, they decided to have a little bit of a backup. They added to the sandwich broken glass, carpet tacks, and even the chopped up sardine tin itself to the sandwich. Now, Malloy ate the sandwich in its entirety and asked for another.
Okay, in his defense, when I've been hammered after a night out, I have eaten some questionable things. Well, you know, weird kebabs from fucking shady chip shops, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I would know if there's glass carpet tacks and the cut-up tin of the mackerel, even the mackerel itself is enough to raise your eyebrows, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, there's not really a scientific explanation as to why he didn't die from this sandwich. He should have died. He was probably just a tough son of a bitch. He should have died. He was shitting out tacks. Come on. That's not normal. So he should have died, but he didn't die. After three attempts to take his life, the men would have to think outside the box a bit more. I mentioned that one of the members of the Murder Trust, Frank Pascal, was actually an undertaker. He had seen many different forms of death, and he had recently buried a man who had died from eating rotten oysters. "Golly gee," Frank said to the other men, "maybe this will finally do the trick." That was obviously not how Frank spoke. He was an Italian from New York, but that's how he sounds to me with this fucking story. "Good Lord, why is he not dead yet?"
"I know about this darn son of a bitch who died from oysters."
There you go.
I'm sure he sounded a lot more intimidating in real life, you know, the Italian New Probably, York.
Yeah, Italian in New York. "This guy's gonna fucking die. He's gonna fucking die. I'm gonna feed him some fucking oysters." Anyway, they soaked a jar of rotten oysters in formaldehyde and fed them to Malloy. And finally, he still didn't die.
Fucking hell. I thought this was gonna be the end of his story.
Well, it became obvious that food and drink would not kill Malloy. Something about this man was apparently very strong against any sort of internal damage. Now, I should point out that the Murder Trust were still paying Malloy's insurance premiums at this point, so they were not happy.
They would have probably lost money.
They literally have been paying the payouts the whole time, so they are very, very upset. Now, Marino was particularly upset, because he had not had anywhere near this much trouble killing off his tiny ex-girlfriend, but that gave him an idea. He would kill Malloy the exact same way he had killed Mabel.
Freezing the head.
Well, not just the head. The whole body, really.
I don't know. In my head, I've got a vision of him like, dunking it just over the head in the wagon. Just a frozen head. Look, yeah, yeah.
A drunk person just going, tunk, just dunking him in. Well, the trust got Malloy drunk again to the point that he was completely blacked out. The men then dragged his body to a nearby park, pulled off most of his clothes, and dumped cold water all over him. This, like with Mabel, occurred during the extremely brutal New York winter. The men then left him there to freeze and waited anxiously for the death to appear in the newspapers. But it never did.
He walked back into the bar, didn't he?
One evening, Malloy strolled into the speakeasy once again, sat at the bar ready for a drink, only complaining of a little chill.
Fucking hell. What did this dude look like? Was he a heavy man?
He was described as a heavy man, but he was only 6 foot 180. I believe, is from the information that I found. He was only 6 foot and 180 pounds. So, I mean, he had a bit of meat on his bones, but it wasn't like huge. He wasn't fat, so I don't know, but he was obviously a drunk. So maybe he had a huge stomach or something like that. Either way, he had apparently been found by police and taken to a hospital. And then there he was given brand new clothes and then just released. However, as a little bit of poetic justice, one of the men in the Murder Trust who had helped carry Malloy to the park had gotten a cold that night.
Fuck that dude. Whereas Malloy is just fine.
He's fine. He's like, that's a bit nippy, isn't it?
Got a bit of a sniffle this morning. Don't know how I got that. Did any of you guys see me walk to the park? I must have gone there and got naked. Pretty funny, right?
He's probably done that millions of times. He's probably conditioned himself to do it.
But not the first time he slept in a park.
Well, he was homeless, so he probably wasn't.
Oh, was he homeless as
he
well?
He was homeless. Sorry, I should have mentioned that, but he was homeless.
Oh, that's the first. If he's homeless, that explains it.
Well, he lived in the bar.
And he
much.
Is also Irish. You know, if you're from Ireland, you're not used to a hot climate. If anything,
exactly.
You're cold, you suit.
Exactly. Well, the men were done by this point. They had had enough of Malloy. They had already put a lot of their money into this scheme. So much money by this point that they were lucky to walk away with half of the profit they initially would have gotten. And it was finally decided that more physical acts were necessary. So, for this, the men looked to the previously mentioned Hershey Green, the cabbie. Now, the plan was simple and easy to execute. The Murder Trust would get Malloy drunk because that was necessary for all of their plans, it seemed. They would then make it look like Malloy was struck by a car.
I knew that was coming. Is this what they've come to now, Lord?
This is what they've come to.
Well, it's just like they've got a big chalkboard. Like, screw it up. Like, okay, here's one. We fucking run him over. That's all I've got now.
Fucking just run him over. Run him over.
We take the car and we just smush him with it. That's what we got to do.
Well, Since Malloy was known to the local area as a homeless drunk, it was easy for people to assume that he had been drunk and swaying a bit too much and was accidentally struck by a car. That's relatively easy to put together. And Hershey Green, since he was a cabbie, was the perfect person to do the striking. Because nobody else had a fucking car. I don't know.
Something like that.
So, once Malloy was completely tanked, the men dragged him out to the car and drove him to a street away from the bar. He was placed in the middle of the road, and Hershey, along with the other Murder Trust members, rode in the taxi while they ran Malloy over. Job done. Or so they thought.
Didn't kill him, did it?
Malloy arrived at the bar a few weeks later. No more the worse for wear.
Look at, for some reason I can just picture fucking Barney from The Simpsons. That's who I'm starting to picture as Malloy.
That's pretty
now.
Much it. Yeah, that is exactly almost it. Malloy had suffered a broken collarbone and a bump to the head, but a police officer had found him in time to get him to a hospital before any real damage could occur. He was treated and released with fairly mild injuries.
What do you mean any real damage could occur? Like, if you get run over, the damage is pretty instantaneous, you know what I mean? He got run over by a car.
Well, like, if he had any internal bleeding or if he had any sort of any sort of injuries that would have come up if they had not gotten him to a hospital yet. He did have a head injury, so if they didn't treat him, he could have had a bad concussion maybe or something like that. Now, again, some people claim that the reason he didn't receive much injuries is due to him being drunk.
Well, just been limp. Not tensed up at all.
Since you're less likely to go tense while you're a drunk, being struck by a car while drunk might help fight off any nasty injuries you may sustain. He was possibly once again saved by alcohol.
Jesus Christ.
We should have been doing this episode on St. Patrick's Day. I don't know why I didn't think about it.
It would have been a good one.
Missed opportunity again.
It's one of the things, like, I'd feel like inadequate having a drink while listening to this, while doing this podcast, because I'll be there like half pissed off, like two cans, and we're talking about him literally like drinking a whole place dry and refusing to die.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the alcohol was incredibly strong as well, more strong than anything else.
And the fact is, though, he's had three or four attempts on his life now, and I bet he still doesn't even know it's happened, really. I think he probably doesn't have a clue that these have been murder attempts. I think he's just like, oh, I've done something stupid while I'm drunk again.
Yeah.
Silly me.
I think at this point it is 5-6. So he had two attempts with the drinking, two attempts with the food, attempt to freeze him to death, and a hit and run with a car. That's 6 attempts so far.
Fucking hell. I mean, I bet you he still doesn't know that these were attempts. Like, he's just like, well, he keeps going back to the bar.
He's like, oh, they're trying to kill you. They're trying to kill you, Mike. Yeah, but they give me free drinks. So it's like, we're in the Great Depression. What are you going to do? This is the best I would get treated anywhere.
Like, I'm going to die. In this time period, like, we don't live very long. I'm probably going to die at some point.
Yeah. Well, the men were at their wits' end with Mike Malloy. And to make matters worse, there was a gangster that showed up by the name of Tony Bastone. And actually, in the documentary I watched, they do it in Gaelic, but the way they pronounce Bastone is Bastoni, so it's Tony Bastoni.
Tony Bastoni.
Tony Bastoni, yeah.
That's our picture.
Yeah, but it's Tony Bastone. And Tony Bastone had been asking Tony Marino to be let in on the scam. He had finally gotten tired of being patient and told Marino if he didn't kill Mike and kill him soon, then Tony would kill Tony. So there'd be one less Tony.
Tony, Tony, Tony.
Well, with this new incentive, Marino developed a new and final plan. They once again got Malloy drunk, of course, and then took him to a nearby hotel where they had rented a room. Once in the room, the men placed Malloy on the bed and unhooked the tube from the gaslight in the room. They put one end in Malloy's mouth and turned it on. They held Malloy's mouth and nose closed until finally they succeeded in their attempts at killing the indestructible man.
He's not dead, is he?
No, he actually died.
Oh, fuck.
I know.
I've been rooting for him now.
I know. I'm sure, well, he might have, if he came back as a ghost, he would be the chillest ghosts in the world, just sitting at the bar.
He'd come back as a ghost and wouldn't even know he was a ghost. Like.
No, he'd be like, hey, guys, where's the beer?
where's that sweet mackerel sandwich you gave me last time?
That was banging. Now, it's claimed by at least one account that with all of the free food, the free booze, all of the planning, all of the paying people off, whatever, the murder trust had actually spent almost half of what they were meant to make from the killing.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately for the men, only one of the insurance policies paid out, and they only paid $800. To help alleviate this somewhat, Pascal the Undertaker wrote a check to the insurance agency saying that he would be paying a large amount of money for his friend's funeral, for Mike Malloy's funeral. So they also received another $400 from the insurance company. So in total, they pretty much received $1,200, which is less than half of what they had wanted to receive. And obviously, they pocketed this $1,200, but they had to split it between themselves five ways.
It's not the same, is it?
They pretty much made a huge loss.
Jesus.
And a bit of a smack in the face to Mike Malloy. They obviously didn't use the £400 to pay for his funeral. Mike Malloy was buried in a $10 coffin and a $12 grave.
Well, you're dead, aren't you? He ain't gonna know.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I think he went out doing what he liked doing. not huffing gas, but you know what I mean. Look.
He died the way he lived.
Being smothered and having a gas tube shoved down his throat.
Live for this shit.
This is such a fucking rush.
Well, the men also had to pay off a doctor to list the cause of death as pneumonia and to bypass an autopsy. Malloy was quickly buried by Pascal before anyone could know the wiser. However, good old Tony Bastoni, or Tony Bastone, was about to make a reappearance, and the story was about to take a turn.
There's more.
While in Tony Marino's speakeasy, Bastone got into an argument with another gangster by the name of Joseph Maglione. Now, apparently, Maglione had wanted a piece of the murder trust pie as well. And the argument between the two gangsters escalated, and Maglione shot Bastone dead. Maglione was arrested for this murder, and this was the last thing anyone wanted, a death in the speakeasy. Now, you see, just after Malloy's death, rumors started spreading around the local neighborhood about what really could have happened to poor old Mike. The only people he was ever seen with were his friends at the speakeasy, so people started to form their suspicions. Eventually, everyone began to believe that the five had killed Malloy, including the police. Took the police a while to get there, as always, but they got there, and they eventually started thinking it was them as well. So, with Maglione in custody, the police decided to offer him a deal if he were to rat on the other members of the murder trust, which he did hard.
Did he go full, what, Takeshi 6ix9ine on them? Just fully dropped everything.
He dropped everything. All of the men were arrested, while Malloy's body was actually exhumed and given a proper autopsy. Unfortunately for the murder trust idiots, Pascal had buried Malloy without embalming the body, and because of this, the carbon monoxide used to kill Malloy gave his body a red tint, which quickly pointed towards monoxide poisoning. Had Pascal actually embalmed the body and done his fucking job, this would not have happened.
I was going to say, he's literally an undertaker, isn't he? Like, he should have kind of known better.
He should have. Now, further to this, along with the testimony of Maglione, the cab driver, Hershey Green, also turned state witness and testified against the men while confessing to his crime of running Malloy over with his cab. But I didn't kill him.
Well, he's not lying. He didn't kill him.
No, exactly. No, I don't know if he actually said that, but I can imagine he's like, no, I hit him, but I didn't kill him. No,
it's crazy accident, man.
It's nuts. Well, with this information, all of the men tried to turn on each other, trying to get out of any punishment they could. However, it was all in vain. All of the men in the murder trust, except for Hershey Green, were charged with first-degree murder and sentenced to death.
Oh.
Each of the men died in the electric chair in the Sing Sing prison outside of New York City.
Not a fun way to go.
Not a fun way to go. At all. electric chair is a terrifying way to do it. If you want to know, get an idea of how these people died, obviously you can watch movies like The Green Mile and that sort of thing. But if you want to see something specific to this one, just Google Mike Malloy on YouTube. You'll find a documentary that's actually somewhat half and half in English and in Gaelic, but it has English subtitles. But it's done by a guy named Malloy who went in, researched Mike Malloy's background and all that stuff. And he actually goes to Sing Sing prison, and they show him the room where the electric chair used to be housed. And they have a chair in the center of the room where they let the guy sit, and they describe it. And they say, well, if you look, he says, is it painful? And they're like, yes, it is absolutely painful. If you look at the arms of the chairs, they're covered in nail marks from where people are scratching at them, trying to
hold on
basically from all of the pain they're experiencing. Terrible way to die.
It's the one, it's something that we used for a long time, specifically for the only method of, you know, only reason is to end someone's life.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't effective, really, was it?
No, it's crazy, man.
Like, I suppose some people did deserve the painful death at the end, but I'm sure a lot of people who got put to death probably didn't deserve that bad of a death.
No, I can imagine they didn't. Well, we will cover one in the near future of somebody that was put to death by electric chair, and it was not deserved whatsoever. But it is poetic justice, I suppose, for Mike Malloy.
Mm-hmm. How would you rather go? Was it carbon monoxide poisoning or electric chair?
Am I drunk in both scenarios?
electric chair, you're not drunk. The poisoning, you are drunk.
Definitely poisoning, because I won't know. If I'm drunk enough, I won't know what the hell's going on. But electric chair, it's the build-up to the electric chair. Plus, it lasts for like 30 seconds. So you imagine,
I bet you hear the switch go down as well. Oh, and you're like, well,
it's not an instant thing. You just sit there and it happens and you... oh my God, I cannot imagine. It sounds like the worst way to die.
It literally fries your brain.
Yeah, sounds like the worst way to die. Well, greed causes so many issues in our lives and the lives of others. These men, the Murder Trust, felt so much greed that they felt it necessary to kill a down-and-out homeless man just to make a quick buck. But we should also remember the time in which the story takes place. This was a desperate time, like I said, and people were starving. Their families were starving. And in the most terrible conditions is where we see the true awful side of human nature and the lengths we will go to survive in these desperate times. But even still, this meant the death of a poor homeless man who really only wanted a drink and maybe some friends. And that, my friends, is pretty unfortunate.
Truly unfortunate. It just kind of gets you thinking, though, in this kind of thing. Like, we like to think we're civilized now, but I guarantee if everything's shut down, like all the shops, we didn't have access to food or anything like that, and all our money dried up, I'll give it 2-3 weeks till we're all apes. It's like just killing one another.
Dude, we almost ran out of toilet paper and people almost beat grandmothers to death because they couldn't wipe their ass with a piece of paper. Like, are you kidding me? And there were so many paper towels available. There were, like, you know, aisles of kitchen roll.
Just use a newspaper. Like, there's other options, you know, if you run out.
Get in the shower, you know? Get in the shower.
Use your hand and then wash it.
I would get in the shower. I'm telling you, you need a shower anyways, listener. Like, if judging by our demographics, you definitely need a shower. No, I'm kidding. I want to say, sorry, we're a day late for getting the podcast out. I think last week, we were like, we will be releasing every Monday.
This is the first episode since we signed that. And we can't release it this Monday.
Sorry. No, I'm sure our fans are not that petty, right?
Our listenership just goes down.
Yeah. We have gotten quite a few listeners, so thank you so much. It keeps growing. It's crazy. Thank you guys so much for helping us out. It always helps it if you share it and stuff. I got to be honest, social media is mentally draining for me, so I don't know if I can keep it up very long. So we really rely on you guys to help us tell your friends and family, people that you know that might enjoy the show and stuff. That really helps us out, because otherwise I'm just drowning in mental issues with social media. I can't take it. It's so terrible. But
it's not great.
It's not great. So definitely keep sharing the podcast with your friends and family. I only care really if you guys are listening. I don't care if you follow us on Facebook and all that stuff. I don't really don't mind. I just, you know, if you guys are enjoying the show, listening, if you want to interact with us, you can always interact with us at our email, info@unfortunatehistory.com. Feel free to do that. More than happy for you to do that. As opposed to following us on social media. It's a cancer. It's a cancer on our lives. It's taking us out day by day.
And yet none of us will delete it.
None of us will delete it because it's fucking business, man. I hate it. I hate it so much. Want to give a shout out to Lee. Give a shout out to Kat. Give a shout out to Lewis. All these people were... have been commenting and stuff on our stuff on social media. I do notice it, even though I don't post as much. So thank you guys so much for doing that. Get in touch. I would love to, for you guys to get in touch with us. If you want to follow the show, please go to unfortunatehistory.com. That's the best place. You can see all of our stuff there. Sign up for our newsletter. We've got some people signed up for our newsletter. That's a great way to stay in touch. We're going to start throwing all of our stuff on there. And we'll also be giving out like discounts for merch and all this kind of stuff for anybody that's on our newsletter. So just go to our, go to unfortunatehistory.com. At the bottom of the page is, there's a subscribe option. Just put your email address in. We don't ask for your name or anything like that. You don't have to be that upfront with us. We don't mind. We just need your email so that we can send you all the deals and all the information, and all that kind of stuff. Feel free to do that. If you want to follow me, just Google Cody Pennington. Greg?
On Facebook, it's just Greg Skinner, and on Instagram, it's still Fly to the Emu. So if you want to follow me on either of the cancers, you can.
Love it. Love that shit. Well, I suppose that's it. I hope you guys enjoyed the story of Mike the Durable Malloy.
I have a lot of respect for the man.
I have quite a bit of respect for him as well. I think I could have, you know what? He's the kind of guy I'd like to have a beer with.
Or 200. And a manky mackerel sandwich.
He would just take my beer.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I think we got to go. So thank you guys so much for listening. Stay unfortunate.
Stay unfortunate, guys. Ta-ra.
Bye. Bye.